Well, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra will open its season on Sunday with a concert once again in Chenery Auditorium at 4 o'clock. And once again, I'm happy to welcome back conductor Andrew Kohler to introduce us to the music on this program and introduce us again to the wonderful young band that year after year puts out such exciting performances. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, as always, Kara, for having me.
Once again, you've got some familiar faces and a few brand new ones, trying to understand, you know, how the rehearsal process and works and what being an orchestra is all about.
Yeah, this is the greatest joy and the greatest frustration of the youth orchestra life cycle, right? It's that just as you feel like you've reached a really good point with with one particular iteration of a group of students, a lot of those guys graduate, go on to all kinds of other exciting things, which is, of course, long-term, exactly what we want for them, are very proud of all their accomplishments and successes. And then you got a new group, and teaching that new group can be really tricky sometimes, you know, because you just really feel like you're restarting. But there is a beautiful thing. I mean, that was a sort of glass half empty version of things, but the glass half full is seeing those new people helped along by the people who had already been there for a few years. Mm-hmm. So they've become more experienced. They step into those leadership roles that you weren't sure sometimes, even sometimes a few months out from the start of a new year. I'm not sure who's going to step into this new leadership role that's going to be vacated by someone who's graduating. And then you hear a chair audition, or you just suddenly get a glimpse of somebody in the orchestra whom obviously is already talented. They wouldn't be there if they weren't, but you weren't sure that they were going to be really ready to take on that increased responsibility and become a leader in their own right. And it's really, really rewarding to see somebody step into that role, because in the end, you know, orchestras are it's a beautiful thing that they're stronger than their weakest link, so to speak, you know. So one really relies on the leadership of a couple key people who really kind of help rise the tide for all members of the orchestra.
So even if you're tempted to step in and you know, explain things to people, maybe you have to restrain yourself so that those young more experienced players will think, maybe I'll just tell my seat partner here this is how it works.
I mean, there's no shortage of me still explaining things. I'll be honest about that. But it is also really beautiful to see a section leader turn around to her section and say, "Hey guys, can we watch out for this or do that?" Or to ask me, "Can we change this bowing? Because I just don't feel like it's working for this section," which is great. Maybe it's not. Maybe we do. It would be more successful if we try this other thing. Or just to see a woodwind player who after several tries finally nails that solo that they've been struggling with for a little while, you know, and finally has the confidence to really put it out there in the way that it needs to. That's another, especially for a wind and brass player, another big part of the discovery of orchestral life is that they may have fewer notes to play than they do in their bands, but those notes are often more, I don't want to say more important, but more critical, because there's not so many, right? I mean, there's only one first clarinet as opposed to many in the band. So that sense that all of a sudden you must work between a group dynamic and then suddenly a soloistic dynamic, it's a hard transition to make, and it's a definite a learning experience for many of our students. But it is really truly a beautiful thing, especially when you see, like I say, those students who you know are talented, but you just don't know exactly what their trajectory might be in the orchestra, and then all of a sudden they sort of catch you by surprise because they've become the great leader you were looking for. You needed to step into that power vacuum that had been left by a graduating senior.
Well, before we move on to the works on the program, I just wanted to add one more thing to say, and that is how much I enjoyed having a session with the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra Woodwind Quintet.
Yes.
Last spring. Most of them were moving on to college.
That's right.
Time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that group, that's a perfect example, right? I mean, that was really one of our, I think, you know, both in terms of personality and well-matched musical ability, one of our strongest quintets. And yeah, we'll certainly miss many of them, but most of those guys are on to other things now.
And I learned at the time that, you know, behind the scenes there are true professionals, local professionals, helping with guiding both small ensembles and sections. And
oh, absolutely. I mean, our enterprise would simply be impossible without the constellation of great local musicians that not only directly impact our students in those on those sorts of terms, right? I mean, people from the KSO, local teachers who are coaching the quartets, who come in and coach, say, a first violin sectional or a woodwind sectional, but also, of course, the private teachers and all the school music teachers who are helping these students get their first starts in music and shaping them into the musicians that can eventually come into this sort of, you know, honors ensemble, so to speak, that takes some of the best from all area schools. So that entire network is something that I and the entire Junior Symphony organization always feels intense gratitude for. I mean, I realize this is a hoary cliche, but it really does take a village, and everyone plays such a crucial part in that network.
And a few times a year, we can all come out and enjoy the music created by the KJSO, and the symphony performs this Sunday at 4:00, the opening concert. You've titled Shifting Landscapes. Mm-hmm. I can see from the first selection that's we're talking a sort of a liquidy kind of landscape.
Actually, quite a lot of them do end up being liquid or liquid adjacent, as it turned out. I do confess that, but they're all in very different places, and I sort of structured the program both in a way that I thought would work musically, but also which kind of visually works. And what I mean by that is that each one of these is meant to depict some natural landscape. Those are the shifting landscapes. And taken as a whole, it does feel like a very satisfying journey through nature, one that would not be possible to undertake in an hour, as we're going to do, roughly. So we start with the music of Mendelssohn that kind of gets us on the sea, just off outside of on the coast of Scotland, on some islands on the coast of Scotland.
Very remote.
yes, very remote. We're definitely, but it's a very extraordinary cave structure that really struck Mendelssohn. So that's where we begin. And then we move deep into the forest. Sorry, I'm trying. I grew up in the Philadelphia area, so I'm trying. Forest is, I believe, how the people of Michigan would understand it. My natural inclination is to say forest, but anyway, yeah, the one with all the trees and the darkness. That's the second selection. Then we go high up into the mountains and see another lake, but it's as much about the lake as it is about the mountains surrounding it and that incredibly dramatic landscape. And then finally, we go to the sea proper. So rather being, we return to the sea, so to speak, but rather being on the sea and looking inward towards land, as we do when we begin with the Mendelssohn, we're out on the sea looking outward and actually just going out into the great expanse of the sea. And so those composers who were painting all these different landscapes via music were Mendelssohn and then César Franck, and then a relatively unknown name, Zygmunt Noskowski, who is new to me too, but I'm really excited to have discovered. I should be careful using that term. Obviously, it was a personal discovery. Obviously, he is known to many others. And then we finally end with the music of Ernst Bloch. So I love the sort of architecture, if you will, I guess, of these different landscapes, especially because it sort of seems like we go from sea level to way above sea level in Noskowski and then back again. And each one has, despite the very often frequent presence of water in these landscapes, a very distinctive sensibility.
Well, and from my perspective, Andrew, once again, you've jumped the track on the typical classical, the expected classical pieces. And we're like off-roading with Andrew Kohler through music that, once again, is undeservedly neglected and has so much to offer the young players as well as the audience.
And I promise you that this is not, how do I want to say that? This is music that, though not well known, especially on her second half, is so, I mean, I am, there are times when I program things that I really love, but I can understand perhaps why they've not met immediately with with audience warmth, because I recognize them as having a thorniness that takes maybe a little bit of time to really start to appreciate, even though I still think they're extremely valuable pieces. These pieces are all speak so immediately about the landscape they're trying to paint that I can't imagine any audience not loving them from a first hearing. I mean, I know that that was the case for me, loving them from a first hearing, and I think it would be the case for just about anyone coming with open ears to listen. Yeah.
So this is such genius. Da 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 da. That's all it takes to get the ocean like heaving.
Exactly. No, that's that's beautifully put. And the thing I especially love about that little, you're of course singing the opening tune to the Hebrides Overture by Mendelssohn. This as I described it, incredibly sort of geometric rock formation, cave archway that's on the side of a remote island off the coast of Scotland that Mendelssohn saw in his travels there, and he was so struck by it. And what I love about it is that, you know, Mendelssohn said very famously, this was a composer who composed songs without words. So while there's this big debate about, you know, how narrative should music be? Should it be describing? Should it have a text with it that kind of helps you set the scene? And it's very interesting because different composers on this program decided different things. But Mendelssohn was always very against this approach. And he said, words, everyone thinks words are so specific, but it's just the opposite for me. Music tells something much more meaningful, much more specific. And you think, oh, well, that's an interesting quote, and that's very nice, but, you know, practically speaking, that surely can't work out. But in fact, he sent a postcard to his equally musical sister, Fanny, and what he put on the postcard, he said, "You'll understand why the Hebrides meant so much to me, because this theme immediately came into my head." And he sketched out exactly that thing you just sang. So here he was really sort of, you know, walking the walk, as it were, truly believing in the power of music to communicate an idea. He felt that that was more a more direct way to communicate with his sister than simply writing out, "Oh my, how beautiful and how majestic and how impressive they were." No, he just said, look at this. And then you'll understand how much I was moved by them.
Well, why don't we let an orchestra play it much better than I sang it, and we'll listen to...
or than we said it, right?
Just a taste of the Hebrides Overture, which is the opening work on Sunday's concert at 4 o'clock at Chenery Auditorium. The Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra will be led by my guest, Andrew Kohler. Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, also titled Fingal's Cave. It's a real place you can visit.
That's right. Yeah. And a real place that Mendelssohn did visit and was so struck by. Actually, two of his greatest works come from this area, so to speak, because then he also wrote his Scottish symphony shortly thereafter. Clearly, he was a favorite of Queen Victoria's, I think. Was she already in power by then? Pretty sure that was the case. And she had an especially long reign, right? So I think
almost
the entire century, right? So yes, it definitely covered it, and was a frequent guest there in the British Isles.
Yeah. Is it a real, like, just so satisfying to look at the score and see how beautifully compact this 10-minute overture is? And it's Mendelssohn, one of the handful of people that showed such promise, like such prodigy as a young person, and already had that sense of balance. And
I mean, that's really the extraordinary thing. It's funny you use the phrase promise, and it's not even promise. It is just full-fledged, fully formed, you know, springing from the head of Zeus, like Hera, already, you know, perfect. It's that kind of music making. In a lot of ways, some would argue that some of his most perfect creations date from his teenage years. This is, in fairness, a later creation. I mean, he's already an adult, not old. I mean, he's only, I think, in his 20s when he visits, maybe late 20s, just on the cusp of 30. I mean, he didn't live a very long life either. But yeah, already he was writing things like the Octet, which, I mean, if you love chamber music, I can't think of a much more perfect piece than that. And things like the Overture to Midsummer Night's Dream. He was writing those when he was 16. Some of his first string quartets. Just extraordinary how advanced his sense was. And not just his sense for structure, but just his instinct for taste, for what he might take from examples of the past and what of himself he might add. I mean, I think that's the really special part, right? I mean, there might be other composers who are really good at following what's come before and creating an original work that is really successful, but to really have already a personal sensibility, you know, a sense of self at so tender an age is truly extraordinary. He really was one of the great child geniuses of all music history.
He was. His teacher made him look at Bach from a young age, mm-hmm. too. Maybe that helped.
Oh, I'm certain of it. And of course, he was then instrumental in creating the Bach revival, because that idea that he was shown Bach by his teacher would have put him in a minority at that time.
Yeah.
That is to say, Bach would have been largely forgotten by that point. Or if anyone thought of the name Bach, they would have thought of the sons, maybe.
Yeah.
In a generation earlier. But J.S., no, he would have been largely forgotten. So there's that extraordinary story of him putting on the passion for the first time in Europe and really reigniting a kind of, I mean, there's good and bad with that, because it ushered in an age of historicism in Europe where there was a lot of, we'll never be as good as those guys back then again, kind of sensibility and just a sort of slavish looking backward all the time. But it also deeply enriched the music making of that time and made it a conversation across centuries.
César Franck, unlike Mendelssohn, is more of a late bloomer. He kind of earns his sense of taste and style over an obscure career as an organist for the most part.
Right.
Then has an amazing impact late in his life on the next generation of French composers. So he lived... maybe they crossed lifetimes, but...
he would have definitely been in the... His prime would have been in the latter half of the 19th century, whereas Mendelssohn's was in the first half, yeah.
César Franck's The Accursed Huntsman.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't listened to it in forever. I kind of forgot that it was out there. I still think of, you know, Franck's sonatas and organ pieces, but The Accursed Huntsman.
It's such a great title, right? Yes. I mean, you're already like, oh, go on, I'm listening. it is an utterly fantastic piece, and I, for the life of me, cannot figure out why this seemingly once more popular piece has somewhat fallen out of favor with orchestral performances. It's brilliantly conceived, and is a piece that, unlike Mendelssohn, who I was just saying felt like words were not all that specific. He wanted to communicate in music, in pure music, as much as possible. And even when it was an image, like Fingal's Cave, that inspired him, he still, when he set pen to paper, let music do all the talking, so to speak, in terms of setting an atmosphere. That's all he gives you. This is where it was, you know, Fingal's Cave, that's it. On the other hand, Franck very clearly aligns his music with a story that he's trying to tell, which was also, you know, a fairly popular device in the later 19th century among certain kinds of composers, and especially a composer like Franck, of Franck's sensibilities. That is to say, someone who was quite a big fan of Wagner, who, of course, was as far as you could go in terms of making sure that there was always a story attached to music, because he wrote exclusively operas. But even the next step before that was, maybe I'll just write orchestral music, but always make sure that that orchestral music has some sort of narrative frame that guides it. And indeed, he even goes so far as to make a structure for his music that is based on narrative. That is to say that there are four distinct sections of this music, not typical for the way music would normally be structured, but these four sections correspond very directly to a story he's telling. And so what is this story? Well, it's based on an older medieval German ballad about, and by ballad I mean in this case a ballad poem, about a rich nobleman, German nobleman of the Rhine, who decides he really wants to go hunting one Sunday. And he's in this little town, and the people implore him not to do this because, for goodness sakes, it's Sunday, it's the Sabbath, it's the day of rest, and one should not go hunting on the day of rest. Well, he thinks very little of these peasants who are, sort of troubling him, and he apparently mounts his steed and sort of, knocks them all about the head and says, "Get out of my way, I'm going hunting, I don't care what you think." And then he goes into the forest and enjoys himself a wonderful hunt, until all of a sudden, this voice from beyond, some other dimension, thunders out that he is now to be cursed for his decision. And that in punishment for his hunting on the Sabbath, he will now be chased by demons forevermore. Huh. Right? So it capitalizes on the idea of the forest. He capitalizes on the idea of it as a place of mystery, of, the darkness, the shade that's provided by the trees, and the kind of spookiness that can come out of it. It's very much in keeping with, say, an early German romantic like Weber and writing his Freischütz Overture, right, which is sort of has the same kinds of feelings, in that it's an opera that's set in the woods and where mysterious sort of supernatural dealings happen, and that then in turn inspired a lot of Wagner's music making. So you can see a clear connection to all of that, that Franck is channeling, using the primeval forest as a kind of place of mystery. But it's a great and very simple narrative idea, and one that is really well expressed by Franck. So I think it really pays off to hear maybe just a little bit of each of these four sections. They all run continuously into one sort of fluid musical idea, but there are clearly distinct subsections that the listener will hear, and we can maybe jump from each one. In the very first, we're just introduced to the juxtaposition of what I described. That is to say, you'll hear at the front French horns doing a horn call, and of course the French horn is just a very sophisticated version of the old hunting horn, that circular hunting horn that someone would have used, especially in the Middle Ages. And then right after that, we hear tolling bells and a kind of imploring theme in the cellos that says, "Come, this is a church day."
I want to jump in and just remind listeners that the Junior Symphony concert is this Sunday at 4:00. And I'm speaking with Andrew Kohler, who's put together the Shifting Landscapes program, and The Accursed Huntsman is second on the program. I am going to switch from announcer to engineer, and I will let you conduct me in and out of this piece, and you can maybe set up each of the themes you'd like to hear. We'll start with the opening.
So you could hear just then that imploring theme in the cellos and the church bells tolling in the distance, which contrasts very sharply with the impetuous music of the horn announcing that it wants to go hunting. And then, very simply, we hear the horn theme kind of reshaped into a galloping rhythm. And there he has clearly mounted his steed and he is off and hunting in the forest. So there was just a little touch of the galloping rhythms that you could hear as the hunt is beginning in earnest. And then when we come to the next section, this climax is several times and then has one big thunderous climax. And all of a sudden, everything sort of empties out and there's just this trembling in the strings. And first we hear the horns play a stopped note, and this is a very distinctive sound in the orchestra. When the horns, by stopped, it is almost literally what it sounds like. They put their fists in the bell, which gives it this very nasal quality and very unsettling quality. And then shortly after, these sort of creepy rhythms in the low strings, over top which we hear a tuba and some clarinets, and then later the trombones intone this very ominous sounding proclamation, which is obviously the curse that's being spoken aloud. And so after that dark proclamation, the music kind of grows in intensity and then finally relaunches into an even faster a kind of hunt. And the brilliant thing here is, of course, it affords Franck musically an opportunity to bring back themes from the earlier hunt, but now kind of reheard. And that makes perfect sense because, after all, this is the beautiful balance of the story. The hunter is now the hunted. As the demons chase him, we hear some of those same motives that were at one earlier him doing the hunting, but they're made more frenetic and frankly more desperate and frantic, and the tempo of the music just keeps getting faster and faster. We'll be right back.
orchestral music got so exciting in the 19th century.
Yeah.
We were just listening to just short excerpts of Franck's The Accursed Huntsman, which is on the program on Sunday from the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra and Chantry Auditorium. Apologies for my amateurish engineering, but I think people got a sense of a lot of the themes and excitement going on in this.
No, the apology is mine. I think conductors are just prone to waving their hands at all times, so I must have made a gesture that was misleading, yes, right? I'd wanted just a little bit more of that galloping section earlier, but I think, as you point out, we got the flavor of it already. And so in these four distinct sections, I really think that Franck does as good a job as I can imagine music ever being able to do of conveying narrative. As long as you have those basic steps in your head, the idea of the conflict at the beginning between the peasants who want him to honor the Sabbath and the hunter, the hunt itself, the curse coming, and then finally the demons chasing the hunter, then the music just sort of comes alive in another dimension. But I will also happily argue from the other side and say that were you not to know any of that, this music works on its own. I mean, it is so visceral and exciting and brilliantly conceived that even if you had no idea that this was the narrative that was being described, I really think that you would still get an incredible thrill from hearing it.
I think anyone who was listening would also be thinking to themselves, the horns certainly have a big role to play. They're absolutely at the forefront of
that. Is very
piece.
True. This is a very horn-driven piece. Yeah, I mean they open it. They open the hunt, of course, because those, you know, as I was saying, it makes perfect sense that Franck would rely on that instrument in the circumstance, because the hunting horn is the predecessor of the French horn, the modern French horn. So yeah, they've got the challenge laid out for them.
Well, this is a great chance to step up and enjoy this role of bold adventurers.
Yes.
Into a dark forest.
Yeah.
Forest.
Yeah.
details are at kjso.org, and the tickets are available at the door or beforehand. Chantry Auditorium is the venue at 4 o'clock on Sunday. We have two more pieces to cover, and hopefully we can just jump right in here to the Noskovsky, which you mentioned before. New composer to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Really, only probably late last year, when I was, you know, sort of starting to think about the programs for this season. There's wonderful resources online. We live in, it's an extraordinary time to be alive, and so, you know, one can find YouTube channels that are dedicated to unsung composers. And I'll be frank, and you know, when listening through them, there's a lot there where you sort of feel like, I can kind of see why this composer is unsung, but every once in a while you come across one that just hits you like a thunderbolt, and you think, why have I not heard this person before on any concert program? Indeed, these Noskovsky parts were so difficult to come by. They're not even in print in the United States.
Is it a Polish name?
Yes, yes. He's a Polish composer of the late 19th century. So he's firmly, he died long enough ago that he would be everywhere in the world, public domain music. That is to say, not under copyright, as some more recent composers might be. But it's not possible to get get parts to this music in the United States unless you rent them from one Polish publisher. So there was a score that was online, again, in the public domain. So the hardy musicians of the Junior Symphony have been having to put up with essentially parts that are cut from the original score, because that was really the only way we could economically make this work. This is all just to paint a picture of how difficult it was to even find this music in the United States. I mean, it's just not very frequently played. Who knows? Perhaps we're doing a national premiere of this work. I have not researched that, so it is a bold claim. I'm just putting it out there because I really have never heard Noskovsky performed. And yet, in doing a little research about him, it's pretty clear that he was an essential figure in Polish music history. He was really thought of as the grand dean of Polish music in the late 19th century, and some of his students included Karlowitz and Gregor Fitelberg, who became a really important conductor of the early 20th century, and probably the most famous composer of the early 20th century in Poland, Karol Szymanowski. So these were all his students. So in some ways, he is perhaps, his legacy is ensured in the sense of him being, he was the head of the Warsaw Conservatory, and he was this great teacher, but he was also a conductor and composer in his own right. And I think a really remarkably successful one. So I actually came across two works, so I hope that I'll get another chance at some point in the future to program another one. One was called The Steppe, which is sometimes recognized as maybe the first tone poem that was written by a Polish composer. And it really does tell the story of the steppe, I assume, in Ukraine, actually, bordering Poland, and which was once Polish land, and that intersection of the steppe is sort of the intersection between that and where they met with the Russian front. But this tells a simpler story, and one, again, very much based in nature. Unlike Mendelssohn, there is a short blurb that is on the title page that was in German in the version of the score we were able to find online. So obviously he had some German publishers, and indeed he studied for a time in Germany, so he must have had connections in that part of the world. And essentially what it says is something very simple. It just says that this lake, Morskoye Oko, which literally means the eye of the sea, it took me a little while to understand that idea, but there was apparently an old legend from the locals in that area that felt like that there must be a direct sort of line that connected this lake with the sea. It is not salt water, but nonetheless, it was so deep. In fact, the description says that it almost looks black because of its depth. It is a very deep lake, but it's also something like 4,000 feet above sea level. I mean, it's way, way up there and surrounded by these dramatic mountain cliffs. And essentially all he says, he just gives a few facts about it, what it looks like, this what I've already described, and then goes on to say that when there's a storm, the effect is really intensified because the thunder will echo off the mountains and sort of you get this intensification while hearing a storm. And then he says, contrastingly, sometimes in the spring, the perfect stillness of this place, of this moment, is interrupted only by the distant sound of shepherds piping and leading their flocks around. And so quite beautifully, later in the work, we get to hear both of those ideas made more explicit. There's definitely, I would say, the entire main theme is in a lot of ways somewhat stormy. You hear a lot of like rustling winds. But then there's also a place where it comes back later in the work, which I don't think we'll have a chance to get to today, but we will obviously on Sunday, where all of a sudden the music sort of empties out and calms down into almost a prayer-like texture. And then you hear these little dancing shepherds off in the distance. So it's a lovely work. And I think, again, like Mendelssohn, he mostly is aiming for an atmospheric sort of approach here. We start with a slow introduction that literally and figuratively conveys the depth of this lake. So it starts in the very low strings and they just keep getting lower. And then we sort of pile on the mountains behind it, so to speak, so that as more instruments add in the orchestra, the sort of the range of pitches keeps getting taller and taller above those low strings. It's a really effective opening, beginning, very beautiful, I think you'll hear immediately. And then we can go in a little bit to at first quietly, but then explosively stormy first theme.
Let's give it a listen and remind listeners that the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra will perform the work on its program Shifting Landscapes at 4:00 on Sunday at Chenery Auditorium. I wish I could have let that play to the end. Beautiful piece, brand new to me.
But immediately arresting, you see what I mean? I mean, it grabs you from the very first notes. As soon as you hear that descending cello line, you think, this is going to be something. And indeed it is all the way through. I mean, it's a really superb work, very beautifully crafted, and I'm really think deserves to be heard.
We have one more piece to talk about and preview for Sunday's performance at 4 o'clock at Chenery Auditorium, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra in performance. They, as you can hear in the music, there are many places where these young people have to step up and play all by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's other times when, you know, you have that full force and a feeling of communion together.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a wonderful mix of
challenges. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And we really have to listen to ourselves carefully when we're playing all together, you know, and make sure that things line up, especially in this work, this Noskovsky. It's quite challenging that way.
Well, let's talk finally about Poems of the Sea by Ernst Bloch.
Yeah. So Bloch was originally a Swiss-born composer of Jewish heritage who, I suppose, maybe is most famous for his works which channel that Jewish heritage, things like Shlomo for solo cello. But this is one time when he's not necessarily sort of getting in tune with that past and instead is just really inspired by a natural landscape. He lived for quite a long time in the United States. Was actually sort of the founder and first head of the Cleveland Institute of Music. And while he was there, he took a family vacation to the French part of Canada and Quebec and was on the seaside there. And just sort of spent a long vacation there, kind of getting in tune with the rhythms of the sea. And simultaneously, he was rereading Whitman. And came across a poem from Leaves of Grass called Encabined Ships at Sea. And these two twin sources of inspiration led to these Poems of the Sea. They're in three very short movements. They were originally written for piano and then quickly orchestrated by the composer. And again, I just think this is immediately arresting and beautiful music. So the first movement is entitled Waves, and you can very clearly hear, as his wife put it, that he was looking at the cold Atlantic, as opposed to maybe warmer, tropical sort of sea. And then the second movement is called Shanty, although it's not maybe exactly what I would think of as a shanty. That is to say, it's very inward and pensive and a little bit kind of lonely, very beautiful though, but not sort of a, you know, thumping work song as you might think of a shanty.
Yeah.
Instead, the last movement, At Sea, which I think we can listen to just a brief excerpt of, is the music that has that energy. It is the music that, as Whitman put it, is sort of with the white sails raised, fully feeling myself out on sea. And it's great and enthusiastic and shows a clear love for this final landscape on our program.
Well, it's been terrific to go on this musical adventure with you this hour on WMUK, Andrew. And this concert will prove to have all kinds of musical adventures for listeners. Details at kjso.org. And thank you again.
Thank you so much.